This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A federal judge in Eugene, Oregon, faces difficult decisions in sentencing 10 members of a radical group responsible for a series of fires at businesses and government offices. 20 cases of arson in all, in 5 different states, all before 9/11, which caused millions of dollars of damage but injured no one. The fires were all set in the name of the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. Judge Jan Aiken cites a broad definition in the law that was in effect at the time, which defined terrorism as offense committed for the purpose of coercing the government. If she applies the so-called terrorist enhancement, sentences would be longer and probably served in tougher maximum security prisons. If the crimes had been committed after the passage of the Patriot Act, the penalties would be even stiffer, and the judge would have much less wiggle room. Is a crime against property terrorism? Is it just luck that no one was hurt? How does intent factor in? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later on in the program, singer-songwriter Amy Mann joins us on the opinion page this week to recollect the overwhelming impact of the release of Sgt. Pepper, not 20, but 40 years ago. But first, how do we define terrorism? We begin with Craig Weinerman. He's an assistant federal public defender in Eugene, Oregon. His client was Chelsea Gerlach, a member of the Earth Liberation Front, who's already been sentenced to 9 years in prison for arson. And he joins us from the Don Russ Studios in Eugene, Oregon. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And Judge Aiken charged Gerlach with terrorism enhancement. That was applied in her case. Why?
Well, the judge found in some instances, not all instances, that the arsons that Ms. Gerlach was involved in was calculated to influence or affect the conduct of government by intimidation or coercion. Interestingly, Judge Aiken did not apply it to arsons that did not involve government targets. For example, the ski resort at Vail in 1998, the arson there, and a fire at the Boise Cascade office in Monmouth, Oregon in 1999. So she made a distinction when the target was a private entity, she didn't apply it in that instance, and when the target was a government entity, and for the most part, she applied it in that instance.
Not that she let her off on the others, but they were, if you excuse the expression, simple arson as opposed to the terrorist enhancement in the cases of the government offices.
Well, correct.
And there was another consideration, her cooperation with the prosecution.
Yes. The result of applying the terrorism enhancement in Ms. Gerlach's case increased her sentence under the federal guidelines, which are advisory, from 63 to 78 months. In other words, without the terrorism enhancement, that was the guideline sentence. And with the application of the terrorism enhancement, it increased the potential sentence sixfold to 360 to life, and only because there was cooperation in the case was the sentence lowered to 9 years.
Mm-hmm. Did the judge take into consideration that these were all crimes against property, indeed some of them government property, but no one was injured?
Well, I think the judge did in the end take that into consideration, but she rejected the argument that we made that in order to impose the terrorism enhancement in the first place, the court had to find that the intent was to injure, to kill, to maim. We argued that when the target of the property, when the intent is only to damage property, the terrorism enhancement, the sixfold increase, should not be applied. And the judge found the government did not have to show intent to kill, maim, or injure.
Mm-hmm. Is that the way the law is written as far as you read it?
Well, that's the interpretation Judge Aiken gave. Again, we believed if you looked at a quite complicated law that it also has as an element the requirement that the perpetrator intend to harm people, that intent to damage property is not enough. But the judge again found that that element was not required to be proven.
And the I know that the prosecution's one of their arguments throughout this case, not necessarily in that particular instance, was that the fact that no one was injured was they tried not to injure anybody, but that they didn't was probably more a matter of luck.
Well, the position we took, and I think it's a fair one, that the old saying, Neil, once is an accident, twice is a coincidence, three times is a pattern. You mentioned 20 acts of arson and other acts. It is our position it was no accident, it was no coincidence that the actions in these cases did not result in death or injury to anyone. They were carefully planned, and they occurred at a time and place when people were not be around, and they went out of their way to make sure that no one was physically harmed.
And I know that the prosecution also made a parallel, which your side rejected, but saying, how is this different from the Ku Klux Klan burning down empty black churches?
Well, we were quite outraged by that comparison, comparing these folks to the KKK, because as we know, the KKK did more than burn down unoccupied churches. They bombed a church in Birmingham. They killed the three civil rights workers in 1966. So the KKK was not about damaging property. The KKK was about injuring and killing people. And that's the distinction that the government's argument failed to recognize.
And I know that some on your side also said there is another intent in the government's case here of broadening the interpretation of what terrorism is.
Well, you know, at some point we're going to water down what this term means. If this case, the arson that targets property, if this is terrorism, then we're going to have to come up with a new term to describe what happened in Oklahoma City in 1995 and, of course, what happened on 9/11. Our position is that we should reserve using the term terrorist and terrorism for the most egregious acts of violence that are designed to hurt people and not damage property.
Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Craig Weinerman, Assistant Federal Public Defender in Eugene, Oregon. And let's get Rick on the line. Rick's calling us from Florida.
Hi. I have very strong environmental leanings, okay? Just want to make that clear. But I just don't see how you could possibly not categorize this as terrorism. And to get in these little nuances about, you know, whether or not we meant to hurt people, my goodness gracious, if you're burning buildings down, you've got a pretty good chance of hurting somebody. And what you're trying to do is instill fear in people. And that to me is a classic definition of terrorism.
Well, Rick, interestingly, this law, the Federal Crime of Terrorism, this law was passed in 1996 after the Oklahoma City bombing. And interesting, before this new law went into effect, the definition of international crime of terrorism involved making threats or coercing civilian population. And this new definition, federal crime of terrorism, has eliminated the civilian population aspect of the definition of terrorism and limits it to acts that are calculated to influence or affect the conduct of government by intimidation or coercion. So the concern that you have, and I respect that, to coerce a civilian population, the judge specifically found that in the arsons committed at Vail and Boise Cascade and some of the others, because it was not designed to intimidate the government, it did not constitute a federal crime of terrorism. Hmm.
Yeah, and I understand that, and I heard you say that before. But one of the complicating factors. Thank goodness, I'm not a lawyer. I'd have to deal with all these little nuances in the laws. But you know, I'm just a practical guy. You know, and you know, who was it? The Supreme Court justice that said, I'll paraphrase him. I know terrorism when I see it, and I think most people do. And I just that's the way I feel.
All right.
But
well,
anyway, I think thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Rick.
If I could just say, you know, the law is about nuances and making distinctions. When someone kills in cold blood, we call that murder. When someone commits a homicide in the heat of passion, we call it manslaughter. So we make fine distinctions in the law, and we believe the law should make the same distinction in not labeling terrorism acts designed to damage property and not to hurt people.
Also with us today is Michael Gerhardt. He's a professor of law at the University of Chapel Hill in North Carolina. He's with us today from the studios at WUNC, our member station in Chapel Hill. Nice to have you on the program again, Michael.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And we were just hearing from Craig Weinerman that this law was passed after Oklahoma City in 1998 with this enhanced this terrorism enhancement penalty.
That's correct. Before then, roughly speaking, terrorism enhancement would have been available for acts of terrorism, international acts of terrorism outside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But But subsequent to Oklahoma City, the federal law was revised, and the operative provisions do relate to intimidation of the government or coercion of the government through some act which this statute is defining as terrorism.
And so this would not have applied, for example, with the first attack on the World Trade Center back in 1993?
Technically, no. Uh-huh. No, it would not. And so we've got, but we do have this federal statute, and I think one thing I might just add to the discussion is the federal statute has got to meet sort of minimal requirements of due process, which means it's got to give notice, it's got to be clear which is the behavior that's being penalized, and that's got to give reasonable notice to people of sort of reasonable intelligence. So that's the standard we've got to meet here in this law. And so obviously what the court's doing in this case is trying to define whether or not these acts which were directed at property damage nevertheless were terrorist acts because they had the purpose, if not the effect, of trying to coerce or intimidate government.
And what other cases has this terrorism enhancement been applied?
Well, it's normally applied in cases involving murder or, you know, killing people. Mm-hmm. So what makes this case unusual is that nobody died, and the particular damage here that was done, of course, is to property.
And just to property. And so and the other point to be made is, I guess, that this law is no longer in effect. It's been superseded by the Patriot Act.
Correct. So we've got, in some sense, a narrow application of the law here, but it obviously makes a big deal of difference to these particular defendants. And it does relate to the broader question of how we define terrorism. I might also say that I think as a nation, we can't simply ignore the need to define terrorism. I'm not persuaded that terrorism has to result in damage or the taking of life in order to qualify as terrorism, but that's the big question that's posed by this case and under this law.
And it's the question we're discussing today. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Craig Weinerman, Assistant Federal Public Defender in Eugene, Oregon, and Michael Gerhardt, Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And when we come back, we'll also be joined by journalist Todd Gitlin to remember how this applies in some other historical cases. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Two members of the radical environmental group, the Earth Liberation Front, still await sentencing for their part in arson fires that caused more than $40 million of damage. Eight other members have been sentenced already. The judge in the case said all 10 can be sentenced under what's called the terrorism enhancement, which could mean more jail time and tougher prisons. Is it fair when the crimes involved only arsons on property? No one was injured. Depends on how you define terrorism. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Still with us, Craig Weinerman, Assistant Federal Public Defender in Eugene, Oregon. His client, Chelsea Gerlach, a member of the ELF, has already been sentenced to 9 years in prison for arson. Also with us is Michael Gerhardt, Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And let's see if we can get a caller on the line. This is Aaron. Aaron is with us from Ohio.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on how this seems to be a stigma created out of 9/11 and all of the terrorist scaring going along. And it just seems to me that when somebody tries to make a statement with arson, it just now it can come across so easily as being considered terrorism. And it just seems like they're taking advantage of that opportunity to turn everything into terrorist act.
Mm-hmm. Craig Weinerman, is this? Do you see this in the context of 9/11?
Well, I think it's unfortunate, but yes, and I think the term terrorism has been watered down. This is the first case that I'm aware of that the government sought this enhancement in a property damage, environmental rights, animal rights case. When the indictments were returned in January of 2005, the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez referred to these defendants as domestic terrorists and described what they did as terrorism again for the first time. And, you know, I whether this is as a result of 9/11 or not, you know, you would have to ask the Department of Justice. But it would seem to me that it did have some influence.
Mm-hmm. Just to ask a question, Aaron, if no one is injured, if it's just property damage, if somebody burns down an Army recruiting center or something, that's not terrorism?
Well, it's really, really hard to say. I mean, I myself... I'm a college student right now, and I'm pretty apathetic in the way I think towards these kinds of things, and it really, really depends on, you know, what the goal of it is. If it's to make a statement, then I would say no, and if it really is to terrorize and to kill and maim, then it's a terrorist act.
Mm-hmm. Michael Gerhardt, let's go back to you on this question. You said earlier you think that crimes on property can, in some circumstances, be terrorism. And is the parallel, the other side of this, which I guess Aaron is talking about, is this a part of an effort to suppress dissent?
I don't know whether or not this is a part of an effort to suppress dissent. I think that that wouldn't probably ultimately have much impact on the actual interpretation of the terms of the statute. I think what we've got to figure out is on what basis do we define the terms in the statute? Do we look at the legislative history of the statute? Do we look at the circumstances in which it was passed? Or do we derive a plain meaning understanding of the term terrorism as it's applied here? And I think the judge obviously was trying to follow more of a plain meaning approach in trying to simply define any act which really would be aimed at intimidating or coercing the government for whatever reason, for whatever purpose, that act could qualify as terrorism. And we can imagine a continuum of terrorist activities, some of which were small and some of which could be horribly large. All those things could qualify as terrorism as far as the statute is concerned.
Hmm. Aaron, thanks very much for the call. Joining us now is Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. He's with us from his home in New York City. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
And I was hoping you could put this in some historical context for us. You've monitored social movements like that of the 1960s radical groups. I guess this was before our modern idea of terrorism really came to be.
Right. It was terrorism was a term just beginning to come into currency with the hijackings and occasional bombings. But even then, I think terrorism as such, it certainly didn't have the aura around it, didn't have the kind of magic, you know, sort of black magic dust sprinkled on it that it came to later on.
Yeah, and yet the crimes of groups like the Weather Underground, which involved bombings and did involve people getting killed, those would clearly qualify as terrorism, do you think?
Well, you know, the attempt, the weathermen wanted to build bombs to blow up a dance of soldiers at Fort Dix, New Jersey. Now, had they gotten away with that, it had a terrorist purpose. I think it could legitimately have been called terrorism. Fortunately for everyone but the weathermen themselves, their bomb blew up in a townhouse on 11th Street in New York, and they were the only victims. Three of them were killed. And they decided, therefore, to start blowing up only property, and they were actually rather scrupulous about that, so they didn't kill anyone subsequently. There were a couple other cases in which people used violent means, including another bomb at the University of Wisconsin, and somebody was killed in a graduate student working there. They were, in a sense, interested in terrorism in that they wanted to strike terror in the heart of either a population or the government in order to change policy. So in that sense, they would qualify. But obviously, the aura that surrounds it, they were not part of an international campaign that was that had the sort of redolent, sort of stench of terrorism as it's understood today.
And does that stench, as you call it, does that affect, do you think, activism and radicalism today?
Well, this is an old story. I mean, in the late 19th century, there were a wave of terror bombings by anarchists in Europe and the United States. There were assassination attempts. When an anarchist or somebody, maybe agent provocateur, threw bombs into a crowd in Chicago at the Haymarket, mm-hmm. they intended to strike terror. So this is an old story of elements in social movements who were unimpressed by the limits of means, and they like doing what in the 1960s the Black Panthers, to mention another group, talked about doing something or other, or the sky's the limit, or do something or other, or we'll act by any means necessary. And there's a kind of bravado in it, but it's sometimes a bravado that kills people.
And Todd Gitlin, one of the things the government said in this case out in Eugene, Oregon, is that the imposition of long sentences has a deterrent effect. Historically speaking, do you think they might be right?
I'm not sure. It could very well be that it so discredits a government that's willing to put people in jail for long periods of time for actions that actually are not lethal, that it actually works as a recruiting poster for more such people. So I think that's a dubious claim on the part of the Law and Order Caucus.
Todd Gitlin, thanks very much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia, also author of the forthcoming book, The Bulldozer and the Big Tent. He's been talking to us from his home in New York City. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Mike. Mike with us from Jackson in Wyoming.
How are you doing today?
Oh, very well. Thank you.
Good. My question is, I'm concerned with the broadening of the definition of terrorism, that it might at some time get into acts of civil disobedience where damage might be done to federal property or to private property, but that's not the intent of the action. I'm concerned about that, and if your guest could address that question.
Michael Gerhardt, why don't we turn to you?
Well, I, as I understand it, I think the relevant intent here is going to have to be whether or not the intention was to sort of retaliate against or to intimidate the government. So that's what the prosecutors would have to show beyond a reasonable doubt. And so if you had the circumstances, as the caller just described them, I suppose one possibility might be that could be described as terrorism. But there's something else we've got to sort of keep in mind here, and that is that prosecutors are also important people who interpret the laws and interpret the Constitution. So they have to make a choice as to when they want to ask for this terrorism enhancement. You should also keep in mind that judges are not obliged to impose it. That the sentencing guidelines are now treated as advisory. So the judge could have chosen not to impose this either. So you've got several places along the way in a case where people can decide that perhaps it would be inappropriate to describe a certain act as terrorist or to impose an additional punishment on it because they think of it as terrorism.
And Craig Neil, go ahead.
I just wanted to weigh in on Mike's concern about this being applied to civil disobedience. One of the predicate offenses for the terrorism enhancement relates to destruction of government property. So we could foresee, hopefully prosecutors will exercise discretion and not seek it in that situation, where someone commits an act of destruction of government property and it's calculated to influence or affect the conduct of government, and a prosecutor could seek the terrorism enhancement in that instance. And that strikes very close to Mike's concern about it being applied to civil disobedience.
Well, as we just heard from Michael Gerhardt, the judge can also decide to apply it or not. What did Judge Aiken say when she did decide to apply it?
Well, the judge read the law, and the judge decided that in instances the judge looked primarily at the communiques that were issued by this group after the arsons were committed, and if the communique stated that it was done to somehow affect or criticize the government in some way, the judge applied it. In the instance where the targets, again, were private entities like the Vail Ski Resort and the Boise Cascade, if nothing was mentioned in the communique about what the motive was, the judge did not apply it.
Mm-hmm. And I think some of those communiques did say if there will be no other way to force the government to change, something along those lines.
Well, there were various communiques, and they said many different things. But, for example, in one case where the judge did apply it, the Jefferson Popular Farm arson, the judge found that and mentioned in the communique that the states of Washington and Oregon, if they pass laws dealing with these sort of actions, it would not stop this group. The judge found that was a statement that was designed to influence the conduct of state government, and therefore an arson of a private entity, the terrorism enhancement was appropriate.
Mike, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Jeremy in Minneapolis. What would happen if a teenager purposely vandalized government property such as a road sign? Could this person be charged with an act of terrorism? So, Michael Gerhardt, how literally will this be applied?
I can put on my prosecutor hat, I guess.
Okay.
Well, I think, you know, keep in mind that there are laws that prohibit that. And so we don't necessarily have to even be thinking of terrorism in that circumstance. And I think that one of the things that – so every given situation is going to be – consists of a series of factors that simply have to be weighed by prosecutors. You know, one incident of vandalism may not be terrorism, but it is vandalism, so it could be punished as such. And again, I think that we saw the judge in this case act rather scrupulously in trying to sort of figure out when it would be appropriate to use this enhancement and when it would not be appropriate. And she sort of targeted particular kinds of behavior and evidence supporting intent to do that. And this is the kind of line drawing judges have to use every day.
That's Michael Gerhardt of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Also with us, Craig Weinerman, Assistant Federal Public Defender in Eugene, Oregon. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get Boyd on the line. Boyd with us from Milwaukee.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello to your guests. Basically, I think my questions have been answered, but I guess what I'm still grappling with is it seems like that since the end of the Second World War, this country has had to deal with quite a bit of domestic terrorism. Would they feel that maybe the laws previous to the enactment of the Patriot Act just weren't effective? I know during the 80s there were some acts of terror by some various white supremacist group. One of them actually had killed a radio host in Denver at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still, I guess, grappling with what are maybe the significant differences now, and could this maybe also be applied to maybe radical anti-abortionists,
It's interesting. We had an email along those same lines from Mark. As we parse the definition of terrorism and wonder if the term applies to environmental extremists, it's surprising to me there's little or no mention of right-wing extremists in this country, like the anti-abortion terrorist Eric Rudolph or the student who carried a bomb into Jerry Falwell's funeral a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Gerhardt, the timing of those things, they might not fall under the same pieces of legislation.
Right. So we would have different laws at effect at different times. I might add the Unabomber to this list of people as well. And so I think that what you've got to sort of keep an eye on is what are the predicate acts for this particular for the charges that are being brought. And again, there's going to have to be discretion used by prosecutors and by judges to look at the different factors in particular cases. Throughout American history, if you go back to abolition, to civil rights movement, you could take any example from any of those, I suppose, on either side, and try and use them as some indication or some example of how the current statutes might be applied. But I think the critical thing is to keep in mind that there's a particular kind of intent that's required here. So if the terror is directed at sort of private individuals, not at changing governmental policy, that obviously works against applying the act. But in other circumstances, you may see through a pattern of behavior or communications acts which clearly fall under the statute. And I think the judge tried to sort of narrow her scrutiny to those situations.
Boyd, thank you. Let's see if we get one more caller in. And this is Roy, and Roy's calling us from Denver.
Yes, sir. The reason I'm calling is that as a firefighter, I'm kind of upset by everybody talking about these attacks as being non-lethal. The fact of the matter is that when firefighters respond, we're going in to search and to fight that fire. At that point, the building becomes occupied, and we don't know a building is vacant, even including the arsonist himself, until we actually make that thorough search.
Craig Weinerman, you can also see from a firefighter's point of view that this is not quite as benign.
Well, yes, and I respect the position of all firefighters. I did, ironically, at Chelsea Gerlach's sentencing, she received a letter of support from a firefighter who, you know, notwithstanding what had been done, still supported her.
Was the sister of one of the other?
No, it was a friend. But, you know, the firefighter, you know, makes a good point. And Judge Aiken did, in her ruling, raise that you can never be sure that someone wasn't going to be injured. But again, I would go to the history of this group. A report done by the Anti-Defamation League in 2005 said that no one has ever been hurt, firefighter or otherwise, in a Earth Liberation or Animal Liberation front attack on private property. And, you know, it, that that shows that the persons who committed these offenses went out of their way and carefully planned them so that no one would be hurt, a firefighter or occupant of property. Can something happen? Of course.
Yes,
of course.
Of course it can.
My belief, sir, is that there's not one of them who could really predict accurately when exactly those buildings were going to fall in on themselves.
Roy, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Craig Weinerman, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Craig Weinerman, Assistant Federal Public Defender in Eugene, Oregon. And we'd like to thank Michael Gerhardt as well, Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina, with us today from WUNC in Chapel Hill. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, singer Amy Mann tells us about the first time she heard Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band 40 years ago. This is NPR News.